So, questions now from the floor, from next door as well, because people next door, it's great that you're here. You may not be able to see me directly, but you hope you can hear me and enjoy the teachings today. A question from anybody. It doesn't need to be about the talk, about anything else. Yes? Now that's an interesting question. Can you be a Buddhist Christian or a Buddhist Muslim? And you remember that story of the blind men and the elephant, which the Buddha taught? You know, seven blind men, never seen an elephant before in their lives. They heard the word elephant, they decided they want to find out what an elephant really was. So each of the blind men, they found an elephant, felt part of it, and came back and discussed what they discovered. Now, in this particular story, first of all, one of the blind men felt the trunk, another one felt the tusks, another one felt the ears, another one felt the head, another one felt the body, the sixth one felt the legs, and the last one felt the tail. And then when they described what they'd experienced, their own personal experience, one said an elephant is a snake. Now they felt the trunk. No way! It can't be a snake. It's too hard. It's a plow, which they use to dig the earth. That's what the guy who felt the tusks felt. You idiots! It can't be any of those things. It's a fan like you're using now to fan yourself. He felt the ears. A fan? Where were you born and educated? It's a water pot who felt the head. You're all idiots, said the guy who felt the body. It's a rock. It can't be a rock, it's a tree trunk, said the guy who felt the legs. You are all wrong, I'm the only one who knows. It is a fly whisk. That's one who felt the tail. And they argued, and that is what religion does. Argues on who's right, what different parts of Buddhism does. Mahayana, Vajrayana, Theravada, who's got the right teachings? And even atheists. Philosophers, physicists, who's right? And the simile of the elephant was, don't argue. How about combining our experiences and our perceptions and our knowledges, our traditions even? And if you, those seven blind men, combined their experiences rather than argued who's right and who's wrong, because they seem to be contradictory. And then they would find that an elephant is a big rock on four tree trunks, the fly whisk at the back, a big water pot on the front, above a little bit, and two fans on either side of the water pot, a snake in the middle, and two plows on either side of the snake. And that wouldn't be a bad description of an elephant for someone who can never see one. That's a beautiful description. Why do we argue rather than combine our experiences? And that means it's possible to have peace and harmony in this world. Combine, don't contrast. But that story has another ending. It's actually an adaption about the seven blind elephants who had heard the word man but never seen one before because they were blind. I always wonder what a man is. What is a man? What is a man? So they'd heard this story, you know, in Buddhism about they're finding a man, feeling them, and then combining your understanding. So they all decided to go and find a man each and feel them and then come back and compare notes. So all the seven blind elephants, blind since birth, they all went out, found a man, felt them. When they came back, they all agreed. A man is flat. Unfortunately, that's the only way an elephant can feel a man, by squashing him flat. Yeah. But that's actually, you know, how we look at life. Be able to combine rather than contrast. Yes. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Okay. This is can you choose, in reincarnation, can you choose now which life you're going to go to, or where you want to get reborn? And indeed, it is the Sapurisapugala Sutra, where it actually says, yes, you can, but within the limits of your karma. For example, for those of you who say want to go and visit me in Perth, the only way you'll reach Perth in Western Australia is if you fulfill two requirements. Number one, you want to go there, and number two, you've got the money to go there. If you want to go there but you can't afford it, of course you won't reach there. If you've got the money but you don't want to go, of course you won't reach there. You want to go and you've got the money. And then you'll reach there, Perth in Australia where I live. That's the same with where you want to go in your next life. You have to want to go to that place, and also you have the karmic wherewithal to get there. So you may want to be reborn as the next Queen of England or King of England, but if you haven't got the karma enough for that, of course you can't. Or you might want to be reborn as a wealthy person, or whatever you want to be reborn as. You have to have the karmic wherewithal, and also you want to get reborn there. And it's really strange, I think I told this story somewhere recently, that one of my disciples in Perth, he came up to me one day and he said, I've decided I've done lots of good karma, lots of donation, keeping the precepts, doing meditation, lots of compassionate acts. I've got lots of good karma, so in my next life I want to be reborn as a dog. I couldn't believe him. He said, you want to be a dog? Yeah, I want to be a dog. He said, Ajahn Brahm, think about it. If you're a dog, you don't have to go to school and do homework. You don't have to go out every morning, Monday to Friday, working, getting stuck in the traffic or squashed in the tube train like I was this afternoon, rush hour. You don't have to have a boss from hell always telling you what to do and paying you peanuts for all the hard work you do while the boss gets all the big salary. And you don't have to worry about finances, about food. All you need to do is to sleep all day. And you can eat whatever you want, because these owners of dogs these days, some of these owners feed them human food, steaks and chops and chickens. Wow, dogs these days, they live like royalty. And even when they go out and see them, they've got clothes on, even little boots as well. Sometimes they have socks. I don't even have any socks. Dogs do. And so that's why I want to be reborn as a dog next lifetime. I don't want to go to work and go to school again. I just want to hang out all day, sleep, and just all I need to do, all the work I need to do is to allow the owners to pet me and stroke me every now and again, lick a few kids, and I get a free meal and board for life. And yeah, he had a point. Until I told him, I think it's the same in UK, in London especially, certainly in Australia, after a few weeks as a puppy, they have to take you to the vet to get de-sexed. When I told him that, he changed his mind. He didn't want to be a dog anymore. It's crazy. If you really want to something, that's where you get reborn. Crazy.
Ajahn Brahm?
Yeah.
In Buddhist countries like Sri Lanka and Thailand, they're not very keen on developing the ordaining bhikkhunis.
Uh-huh.
They say something to do with the Vinaya Pitaka.
Uh-huh.
But I think the English Sangha and yourself,
yeah,
you think it's essential to develop the bhikkhuni sasane.
It is essential to develop the bhikkhunis and to support them. The reason why is just after the Buddha's attainment of enlightenment, still under the Bodhi tree, this fellow Mara came to see the Buddha. You all know Mara, for those of you who've gone to Dharma school as kids. He is this sort of equivalent to the Christian devil, but not as mean, but more sneaky. And he told the Buddha, congratulations, you are now enlightened, you're a Buddha, But teaching others, it's just so tiring. Just, you know, just take it easy and just, you know, leave the world so you don't teach, okay? Because he was afraid he would teach and spread these teachings. And the Buddha replied, I will not enter Parinibbana, not leave this world, until I have established a strong, flourishing, sustainable Sangha of monks. Until I have established a flourishing, strong, sustainable Sangha of nuns, bhikkhunis. Until I have established a strong, flourishing, sustainable group of white-clothed lay Buddhist followers. Basically, you know, you women who come here. Until I've established a strong, stable, sustainable group of lay followers. The four assemblies. When they are strong and can sustain themselves forever, then I will leave. And that was why 3 months before his Parinibbana, Mara came again and said, look, you've done it, you've done your promise, the mission completed. Just like George Bush said on that boat, mission accomplished, only, you know, that he was lying. Buddha doesn't lie. This was mission accomplished. And then the Buddha said, okay, 3 months, I will pass away. And that showed that was the original intention, the whole purpose of the Buddha teaching. And so, not to recognize that purpose is disrespectful to the Buddha. Now, he wanted from the very beginning to have those four assemblies, monks, nuns, lay men, lay women. That's his purpose. And so by reintroducing this, and by supporting it, and seeing it flourished, we are doing the Buddha's own clearly declared intentions. And not to do that, to thwart that, is to thwart the Buddha's will. So that's been quite strong. So we have done that now. There's a bhikkhuni right in front of me, an English bhikkhuni. And it's great to see that now. There are bhikkhunis in Sri Lanka. There are bhikkhunis in Thailand. And, you know, there's not many Thai people here, but there's many Sri Lankan people here. For goodness sake, support them. Go to their temples, instead of always going to the monks' temples. The monks' temples, please excuse me, monks around the corner, the monks' temples in Sri Lanka are pretty wealthy. And they've got plenty of resources. They've got nice halls and good huts. They can always use some more, but the bhikkhunis need them more than the monks do. So please, when you go to Sri Lanka, don't go to your monks' temple. Go to the bhikkhuni's temple, because then you are doing something historic and inspiring. You are re-establishing something which has been lost for centuries, and it's in your lifetime. And I've done my bit, you know, by doing the ordination, and sometimes it gives me the goosebumps too. You know, you've actually re-established something lost, which the Buddha wanted. Now there again, you live in incredible times. This is historic. When people write the history of Buddhism, you know, like the Mahavangsa, and they give the extra chapters, they will say, in the early 21st century, the Bhikkhuni Sangha was reintroduced again after it was lost for such a long time. This is massive. But I could ordain them. I can teach them. But I can't offer them money to build the huts and stuff which they need. In Perth, we're doing well, because, you know, I'm behind all this and raised a lot of money for the nuns and monastery. But in Sri Lanka, you know, they're doing it tough, and really you should be ashamed not to support them. And I'd say that in Thailand too. In Thais, you should go. Quite frankly, the monasteries in Thailand are just over the top. Far too wealthy, while the bhikkhunis are struggling just to, you know, get a place to stay at night, toilets. And I am going to California in February. The one purpose I'm going there for is to raise funds for the bhikkhunis in the United States, because they are not supported at all, and they're really doing it tough. And I want to say, are you Buddhists over in Google? What are you doing? You know, you're wealthy. For goodness sake, help support this revival of the bhikkhunis. Vinaya-wise, the rules, it is allowable. It is permissible. All scholars agree. It can be done. It has been done. Just now we need the support. The monks have done their job. There's a few monks who are holding out, but history is not on their side. And the Vinaya, the legalities, are not on their side either. My saying is, when there is a bandwagon, you better jump on it, otherwise you get crushed under its wheels. So, I'm passionate about that, because it's something I can do, it's something you can do, so for goodness sake, do it. This is not Theravada Buddhism, it's not Mahayana Buddhism, this is not Vajrayana Buddhism, this is Nike Buddhism. Just do it. Okay. Okay, I got one over here first of all.
Okay.
Yeah, no, one over here first of all. He has a microphone. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you for the wonderful talk, first of all.
Yeah.
I recently read an article about Ajanta.
Yeah.
When he was asked what Dhamma is, Ajanta answered what isn't.
Yeah.
So alongside our morning and evening sitting, how can we incorporate Dhamma in our day-to-day daily activities?
Okay. When I was at the Thames Buddhist Vihara about 10 days ago, I had the Dana and gave a talk in a house in Kingston, wasn't it, Heranti? Kingston, and we had to go to just the other side of Croydon, and it took 3 hours, because there was traffic jam. And I only just arrived in the temple just in time to give the talk, and I never sort of planned my talks. The reason I did rituals today, because I asked the monk, what should I talk about? He said, rituals. So I just do what I'm told. And this time, I gave the talk on Buddhism and traffic jams. And how you can take Dhamma into your daily life. You're in a traffic jam. You can't go anywhere. Why stress out? You have the great opportunity just to relax. You can't go forward, you can't go back, you can't go anywhere. What a wonderful time to relax on the way to work or relax on the way back home. You're in a traffic jam. That's brilliant. It shows you just can't control life. You just have to let go and flow with life. To let go of all of your plans and just to adapt. And I also told the story, a true story. This guy told me that it wasn't quite a traffic jam he was in India. It was because his driver was stupid and got lost on the way from the hotel to the airport. It was in Mumbai. And he left him plenty of time to get to the airport to catch his flight. He got one of these drivers from the country, you know, just doing some jobs to make a bit of money for himself. He didn't know the way from the hotel to the international airport. He got lost, traveling around the streets. Time was ticking by. And this poor fellow, this business person, he really thought he was going to lose his flight. But you know, in those days, sometimes, and especially in India, there are delays. You know, same as Sri Lankan Airlines, especially Thai Airlines. TG means tomorrow go, not today. So he thought, maybe it's delayed, maybe I can catch the flight. But for once, the flight left on time. Because as they got to the airport, he actually saw his flight take off. And he just got so angry at the traffic, the taxi driver. You know, of all people, taxi drivers, that's the one place they should know how to get to, you know, to the international airport. And he missed his flight, it would cause him all sorts of trouble with connections and stuff. And he was just so angry, you stupid taxi driver, you idiot taxi driver, look what you've done! You've made me miss my flight, miss my connections. What am I going to do, you stupid man? He was so angry. And as he was shouting at the taxi driver, he saw the plane come down, crashed with everybody on board dead. He told me that. And that changed his whole life. You wonderful taxi driver. You're so great. Have 100 bucks. Have 200. So if you're in a taxi drive, if you're in a traffic jam, enjoy it. It could be saving your life. You don't know. So this is how we can take Buddhism into traffic jams. Red lights is another. How many of you get really frustrated at red traffic lights in London? Red traffic lights are Dhamma at every intersection. Remember Angulimala? Angulimala was running after the Buddha, and Angulimala shouted the Buddha, "Stop, monk, stop!" And the Buddha said, "I've stopped, Angulimala, you stop." And Angulimala stopped, eventually became an arahat. So every time you see a stop sign, it's the Buddha saying, "Stop!" And if you understand the red traffic lights, as many people have a chance to become enlightened at the red traffic lights. Stop. Stop wanting. Stop going things. Stay in the present moment. Be here. You can't move. So, stop. Instead of getting angry, "Come on, change, quick. How long do I have to wait here for? Crikey, I'm going to be late. This is disgusting. Why don't they change these traffic lights and give more time? That person in front, he should have gone now. He didn't go and I'm stuck now." That is not stopping. That is missing an opportunity to practice Dharma at the red traffic lights. And apparently it is in Bangalore. I thought it was in Delhi when I first heard this. It was confirmed in Bangalore. They do not have stop signs or red traffic lights when it doesn't say stop at the red traffic light. They have the five letters come out. R-E-L-A-X. Relax. They're not stop signs. They are relax lights. Wouldn't it be great if we did that in London? Every time you get the red traffic light, you can see the words, "Relax." And that's how we bring Dharma into daily life. Just one example. Somewhere over here. Oh, you got, yes?
Ajahn Brahm, in fact, I'm in the health service, and there is so much research, randomized control trials, which have demonstrated the effects of mindfulness on high blood pressure, diabetes, and even in prevention of dementia, some of the limited trials. And in fact, I'm also very interested. I have written a proposal. If I'm not asking too much, would yourself be able to advise if I email the research proposal? Because I'm also planning a randomized control trial to see whether mindfulness, structured mindfulness-based intervention over a period of 8 weeks can provide statistically significant difference in reduction of blood pressure.
That research has already been done.
Yes.
It's already there. But mindfulness is old science. You like to take it to the next stage, which is kindfulness. Because mindfulness together plus kindness is even more powerful than this stuff being called mindfulness. When I was in Nova Scotia, that is one of the things they have in Halifax, Nova Scotia, are the offices of Shambhala's son and Buddha Dhamma and a new magazine called Mindful, supported by John Kabat-Zinn and all the other sort of gurus of the mindful movement. So this is actually cutting edge. You may not have heard about this, but Kabat-Zinn and all the others are very concerned that mindfulness, these are the originators of this mindfulness movement, really concerned it's being divorced from Buddhism. It's like growing a plant, in the house instead of in the garden where the soil is, where all the other nutrients which actually support the plant, can be found. So they're trying to put in these other parts of Buddhism as well, such as compassion. And if you add mindfulness together with kindness, it becomes a new word, kindfulness. And this is like new stuff. So don't do the old research, because it has been done. I advise you, do kindfulness research. Go further.
Thank you for that. But however, I totally agree with you. But what is done in the U.S., it is really not based on multicultural, people of South Asian origin. And London, and this country, we have a unique population, people in deprived population who are affected more with high blood pressure. So that is what I want, because it cannot be applicable directly, because it is on the U.S. population. And that is why I want to see if it works, really we can, although we are Buddhists, how, what percentage of people are doing loving kindness meditation or mindfulness. And so it, if it is part of day-to-day life, then their anxiety, all that can be relieved. So that is what I I'm very keen to do it among multicultural groups in the, not only Buddhists, of course. I want to take really the not only Buddhists, but of course the South Asians, white, British, different people, just to show whether it has an impact, so that it is a randomized controlled trial.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, I know it will work. So I know the results, but it's also that if you, if too many people ask me for help, and I'm the one who gets high blood pressure. Because look, I am really overworked. And you got some good monks here. Use the local monks. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, go on. Meditation question, yeah. Okay. Is it going to be a... Okay, go on. You've got your hand up. Going. You started, go on. I just wanted to do it personally afterwards. But go on, give it a try. Now give it a try. Okay. When the mind comes down in meditation, the mouth opens. This is for the audience. Okay, and the muscles opening by itself, and if you try to close it, you lose concentration. First of all, meditation's got nothing to do with concentration, everything to do with stillness. This is one of my other missions in life. We had a very unfortunate translation of the word samadhi into English as concentration. It does not mean that. It means stillness. And that changes the whole attitude you have towards meditation. And you can see one of the reasons why people don't get success. Because concentration is done by force and control. And that never results in stillness. Letting go is the cause of stillness. Control causes concentration. Two totally different things. So number one, for everyone who does meditation, please, stillness caused by letting go, not concentration caused by control. Now that's Pali, it's clear, and the path is clear when you get to stillness rather than concentration. It's such an unfortunate translation by Rice Davids. Doing his best, but you know, we always make mistakes when we start, but it's got stuck. And the other thing, if your mouth becomes open through stillness, it doesn't matter at all, because it's still, you actually, all your muscles start to relax. When you control, things tense up. So it may be that you are trying too hard. You're trying to get somewhere rather than just trying to be. So I'd have a look at that first of all. We had questions in back, yes, over there. Okay, relink. How does relinking consciousness work in a new life? Now, this whole idea of reincarnation and consciousness is best described by a stream of consciousness. A stream of consciousness like the River Thames. And which bridge did I go over? I went over Battersea Bridge the other day. It looks just the same, the River Thames, as when I was a kid. You know, 50 years ago. But I bet you there's not one molecule of water I saw 50 years ago is there right now. It's all past, but it looks the same. It's a stream. So the stream of consciousness, it's never the same one second after the other, but it's a flow which looks pretty much the same. And that is what goes from one life to another, the stream of consciousness. And the stream, the current, is pushed because of craving, because of desire, what you want to go, do, where you want to go. when it's a strong flood, that's a huge, powerful current. That's when you really, really have strong cravings and desires. You know, if it's just flowing slowly, that means, you know, you're pretty much letting go of things. So that's actually what drives you into your next life. This stream of consciousness, because you want. It's driven by that current of wanting. Okay, another question? Yeah, go on, you got them. Yeah?
Yeah, you've probably heard of anecdotal sort of, you know, accounts of people who've been recipients of organs, you know, donations.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I heard about this American classical music composer who hated rap music, and he really needed a new heart. And after he got his new heart, he suddenly developed a passion for rap music.
Yeah.
And he couldn't work it out. And he just looked into who the donor was, and it turned out that it was a young black man who was a passionate rapper.
Yeah.
And that just changed his life, and he became really interested in rap music. And it sort of suggests that there's consciousness, sort of traces of consciousness, even in our sort of organs. And what does that? What are the implications for that in terms of, you know, things like, you know, if you're... If, you know, people freeze embryos, for example, and you know, in a way related to the relinking consciousness question, yeah. How can you, you know, are you freezing an actual person if you're freezing embryos, and what's going on?
Okay, the first question is that I read a book about that a long time ago, and that effect only lasts for a few weeks, and eventually that person returns to his, you know, old self, if you like, the one who doesn't like rap music. Because that's, you know, probably what happens in many, many cases. There was an amazing case in the book about one person who had a heart transplant. It was mostly done about heart transplants. And she was a young girl, so, you know, a lot of life in front of her, so she was high on the list for a heart transplant. She got the heart transplant. After, you know, everything was a success, she came back home, but she started having nightmares. And her nightmare, always the same nightmare of being murdered. And woke up screaming. And the mother took her to the doctor. The doctor said, no, it's just the trauma of the operation. Maybe some of the drugs. It will go away. But it didn't go away. And the mother was suspicious. She took down all the details, which was a recurrent dream from her daughter, the place, description of the person, a description of what she looked like. She took it to the police. The police were interested because that matched an unsolved crime. And from the description of the assailant in the dream, the police arrested the suspect and he confessed. And the person who was killed was the owner of the heart this little girl had. And because of that memory, after a transplant, they solved the murder. Fascinating. The other case, which is a bit more, the men here who aren't monks will probably appreciate this. Maybe I'll get into trouble for it, but here we go, as a monk. There was, again, a middle-aged woman who had a heart transplant, and that heart came from a prostitute who had been killed, murdered. And when they put this heart into this middle-aged man's wife, when she recovered and went back home, her husband said he was very happy because she was, in his words, very frisky. Afterwards, if you know what I mean, because you had, you know, some vestiges from the prostitute. But again, it only lasted for a few months and then it faded away. So don't think, you know, if you, you know, your wife is giving you a hard time, I'll get her a heart transplant. They usually only last a little while, and it's an interesting effect. And what is actually happening? Is it that the stream of consciousness is still attached to that organ and just is getting into the person's mind? Or is it a fact that, you know, sometimes some memories, you know, are stored in bodily parts, but after a while they fade away?
Would you say things like freezing embryos is ethical according
to
Buddhism?
Oh, freezing embryos is a totally different thing, because for embryos, the Buddha said that life begins as a human being when consciousness first manifests in the mother's womb. Manifests, first appears, you can actually discern it. And for consciousness to be discerned, you know, you have to have vedana, so the reaction to painful and pleasurable stimuli. So this is one of the reasons why when you have ultrasounds, and if you see the this is not embryo, this is fetus, if you see it obviously reacting to painful stimuli, just going away or even smiling and sometimes even laughing, appears to be responding with happiness, then that's when the neural system has formed enough to manifest emotions. And from that time on, said the Buddha, that's when life begins in the mother's womb, when consciousness first manifests there. So in an embryo, consciousness hasn't manifested yet. It's like a car without a driver. So there's no problem at all about freezing embryos or using embryos for stem cell research. No problem at all. And that's actually arguing very closely from what the Buddha said. It's not human life. Okay. In the back, far back. You have to shout this out. And then afterwards over here. Go on. Aha, I'll do that one first of all, and the other one I'll come back to you. I'll go on. Okay. I'll do the second question first. It's with the Vinaya or even with the Dhamma, the teachings of the Buddha, it's important to actually find out what the Buddha really taught. Because there has been a lot of additions in all the traditions, including Theravada. In just the same way, if I got out a copy of Shakespeare and compared it to a volume of Harry Potter, it would be very clear which author was earlier and which was later. The language changes, the vocabulary changes. And that is one of the ways they used to have textual analysis of the Christian Bible and other books to find out when it was written. You apply that scientific objective method to the Buddha's teachings, and the first casualty which Theravada has to get rid of is the Abhidhamma. It was not taught by the Buddha. That is quite clear to anyone who has a brain. And one of the things I say to you, please, as a Buddhist, don't allow your faith to bend the truth. The truth should bend your faith. So you look at the truth, the evidence, first of all, is compelling. It doesn't matter how many Buddhist monks come up and say, Ajahn, you're destroying Buddhism. You're not. You're actually getting closer to what the Buddha actually taught. And same with the Vinaya. There's a lot of additions in there. So we can actually find a means. We don't say, I don't like it, therefore it couldn't have been part of what the Buddha said. You have to have much stronger reasons for it, objective reasons. And many monks are doing that. Two of my monks, Ajahn Bhamani, Ajahn Sujato, Professor Analio, German monk in Hamburg University, is also really the forefront of finding out what the Buddha actually taught. And because I keep myself abreast of such research, and when you find out what the Buddha actually taught, it's incredibly compassionate, wise and practical, and basically that answers the question. The monks have no problem with it at all. It's practical, powerful and really, really kind. So I said in Germany, once you find out what the Buddha actually taught, then you find out what the Buddha actually meant. And when... Oh, please turn off your mobile phones, because if a mobile phone goes off during one of my talks, it's bad karma. Not for you, but for the phone. In the phone's next life, it's always reborn as a parking meter. And a parking meter is the lowest form of life for technology. So, it's okay. So, someone's phone will be a parking meter in the next life. So, once we find out what the Buddha actually taught, the next step is, find out what the Buddha meant. We know what he said, but what do you mean by that? And that's where interpretation comes in. And when you interpret the Buddha's teachings, it has to be the most compassionate and kind of interpretations. Not the harshest, not the strictest, but the kindest. And when you interpret the Vinaya like that, these are the rules for the monks and nuns, it becomes so beautiful, so kind, and so when a monk gets to that level of Vinaya, they love it. There's no problem at all. Now with anatta, is it a truth or is it a practice? I'm sorry, that Tanjef is absolutely wrong there. It's not a strategy. You know, it's a truth, but it's not a truth you can believe. It's only a truth you can discover. So anyone who starts to think about non-self, who starts to philosophize about non-self, who starts to study non-self, is wasting time. You meditate. You become so still that so much disappears. That's what stillness does. When you're still, things vanish. And so much vanishes that everything you ever thought you took to be a self vanishes. It shows you can't be a self. That's in brief. You have to meditate. Basically, you have to get jhanas. Without the jhanas, non-self will be incomprehensible. Okay. Now, I'll ask Lefi because you have asked many questions in all the talks I've gone to. Yeah. Sorry, but yeah.
Good evening. Thank you for talk. And I would like to ask, as a Buddhist monk and science also, do you see any possibility that Jesus was next Dalai Lama and been taken to India and raised, and then he tried to come to Rome and spread these teachings, but the Rome, the apparently didn't really take it right?
Okay, talking about Jesus went to India, and
it was just one of the theories.
Indeed, but there is strong evidence, archaeological evidence, numismatic evidence, which is coins, and there's also textual evidence in many, many old scriptures which aren't accessible to Western scholars but which are accessible to scholars in India. The Indian government did a documentary recently in English but produced by the Indian government, which is so convincing that after the crucifixion Jesus did go to India. But you know, before he was in India, afterwards in India as well. Really convincing stuff.
Yeah, because what about happened on the crucifixion, they say that he actually became a still.
Yeah, 3 to 7 hours crucifixion, ask any doctor, is not enough to end a person's life. That's why crucifixion was just a terrible way to kill somebody, because of how long it lasted, days, until a person died. And that was the really gross part about it. And most people know 3 to 6, 7 hours did not enough to kill you. So it's strong evidence. And also, for those of you who grew up and was taught Christianity, there was the legend that Jesus went over to Egypt, fled from Palestine to Egypt with his family. As refugees, they would have gone to the capital city, which was Alexandria at the time. 4 AD, the historian Philo of Alexandria wrote this book about life and times in Alexandria. And there were Indians there, expatriate Indian traders, to take the goods which didn't go across the Silk Road. They came from the southern port of the Indian port of Soparica. They came across the Persian Gulf. They stopped off in Aden, where there was a lot of Indians in Aden at the time to, you know, look after the business in that port. And at that time, you know, 2nd century BC, Philadelphus Ptolemy, the one which was mentioned in the Asoka columns, he built a port especially on some of the lower Egypt on the Red Sea to take, you know, the goods and to bring it up to Alexandria. And in that port which he built, to this day there are tombstones with Dhammacakka on it, the symbol of Buddhism, and even one tombstone with Buddhang Savanangacchami, Dhammang Savanangacchami, Sanghang Savanangacchami, establishing archaeologically there were Buddhists in that place 2 centuries BC. And that Philo described a monastery just outside of Alexandria, where there were monks and nuns, bald-headed, brown-robed, vegetarians, celibate who celebrated the Sabbath, Poya days. And anyone who knows anything about Buddhism, that's very clear, that's Buddhist monks and nuns. Established as existing by Philo of Alexandria. One of my monks was fluent in Greek, and when I suggested to him, he said, no, that's just, you know, just wishful thinking, Ajahn Brahm. He was going back to Bern in Switzerland, where he lived, and I asked him, you know, you've got a few hours, go to the library, you're fluent in ancient Greek, check it out for yourself, read it in the original, because translations are always very, very dodgy. So he read it in the original, he wrote back to me, apologizing, saying, I thought you were crazy, Ajahn Brahm, I read it in original Greek, I'm fluent in ancient Greek, and he called it a dead ringer for Buddhist monks and nuns, established in a very popular monastery in Alexandria of 4 AD. And sometime after that, according to the Christian Bible, Jesus actually went to Alexandria, where he grew up. And if there was a Buddhist monastery there, he would have surely gone and checked it out. And maybe he was a Buddhist. And so there is credibility there. That, you know, Buddhism was well known in the place where the Buddha grew up. And there's evidence. So it's actually quite compelling evidence. And also, you say, well, why aren't there any scriptures? Well, there are scriptures of what the Jesus said. It's called the Nagamadi Library, the Gnostic Gospels. Anyone who wants to have a look at it, Elaine Pagels, P-A-G-E-L-S, who translated most of them. And in that, they have such sayings of Jesus as, he who knows themselves knows the truth of all things. Jesus said that. And the other quote, which is in the Gospel of Thomas, in the Nagamadi Library, the Gnostic Gospels, what the Professor Pagel says is suppressed Christianity, doesn't get into the Bible, but these papyruses are ancient and chosen an original form of Christianity which was suppressed by the Roman Church. But just as authentic. And the other one, in Gospel of Thomas, that God is saying, I am the creator, the firstborn, the chief, the all-powerful, the omniscient, the omnipresent. And then God hears a voice. No, you're not. Please do not get above yourself, God. There are other beings in this universe which you simply do not know exist. And God said, who said that? I don't know who said that. Who was that? And that is in the Christian Gospels, in the Nagamadi Library. Reportedly sayings of Jesus, which never made it into the Christian Bible. Brilliant, interesting stuff, which also gives some indication that, yeah, it was very close. Check it out. Okay, it's radical, but I have a saying. When I met the president of Dalhousie, which is quite a well-known university in Halifax, I met the new president, and I told him one of my favorite sayings, which should be part of every university's credo, where everybody thinks the same, no one thinks at all. Where everybody thinks the same, no one thinks at all. And he was so happy about that, he said, I'm going to tweet that to everybody. And that should be the credo of universities, where everybody thinks the same, no one thinks at all. So, you know, you get in there, check it out and argue with me. Don't think like me. Yeah.
Hi. How do you see the 998 good bricks within yourself when they seem to be hiding behind the two bad bricks?
Okay. This is my story of the two bad bricks, which I won't repeat. And you, 98 good bricks. How do you see the 98 good bricks? By learning how to receive praise. If that doesn't work, there's another very simple way of doing this. Get a piece of paper. Okay, all the best to you. You've got to go back. Yeah, okay. It'll all be on the recorded somewhere, so anything you need extra. Watch me all the time, so you know this story probably. Sometimes people say, why do you keep telling the same stories? The answer is because you keep asking the same questions. So anyway, 98 good bricks, 998 good bricks, two bad bricks. Get a sheet of paper. put your name on the top. Draw a line down the middle, vertical line. On the left-hand side, describe all your bad bricks, all the things which are wrong with you, all your bad qualities. On the left-hand side, fill it up right down to the bottom of the page. And after you've done that, which you should find pretty easy, all your faults. And on the right-hand side, put all your qualities, all the things you admire about yourself, all the wonderful things you've done, all the sort of great qualities. And you'll find that's hard to do. But you can't stop until you fill up that right part of the page. You can't have a glass of water, a meal, anything. Fill it up. And once you've filled it up, then cut it down the middle. And the left-hand side, with all your bad qualities, just chuck it in the trash can, the rubbish bin. The right-hand side, with all your good qualities, which you had to force yourself to write, put that up in front of, you know, your workstation. Get a copy and just tape it next to your bed so you can always see it in the mirror of your bathroom to remind yourself of your good qualities. Because it's just a change of perception, that's all that's needed. So that's how to do it. You have to do something physical first of all, an action, and writing it on a piece of paper. Left hand side your bad qualities, which you know all too well. Right hand side your good qualities. Cut it down the middle. Throw away the left hand side and keep the right side. Okay. The monks, how long can we go for? Or we can keep on going for a bit longer? Because I'm staying here tonight, I can stay all night. Yeah? Should you aim to be vegetarians? It's good if you can be a vegetarian. But don't try and make other people vegetarians. Because some of the vegetarians I know are pains in the neck. Because they always get on top of you and say, why aren't you a vegetarian, venerable sir? On your wife, you should be a vegetarian. Children, all your friends should become evangelical. You know, just like these people knock on people's door and tell them the good news, only you're telling them the good news about vegetarianism. It's a good thing to do. But keep it personal. You know, when I became a Buddhist at college, I never tried to tell my friends about Buddhism. You know, I never rammed it down the throats. And at the end of my 3 years at Cambridge, I asked them, I said, what do you think about me being a Buddhist? And they told me the thing we respected about it, most of all, is that you never told us. You never tried to change us. It was your personal choice, and that's what we liked about Buddhism the most. So if you are a vegetarian, wonderful. But don't tell anyone. Yeah. How do Buddhist couples share housework? Okay. If you live in the same house, then you have to do the same work. But, you know, that sometimes that people work too much. This is a problem in a house. So, my advice, which I think I gave here last time, is when you go home tonight, and you see all the dirty dishes from the dinner which you hurriedly took to get here, or from lunchtime, before you wash those dishes, count how many clean dishes there are. And if the clean dishes outnumber the dirty ones, quit while you're ahead. In other words, don't always do so much, because then your house is another place of work. You never just...
Who would be doing the cleaning? Would it be the man or the woman?
Okay. It's the one who wants to make the most karma does it first. You know, that's actually what happens in our monastery. Because, you know, I think I did this story last time. Five fingers on a hand were arguing who is the most important finger. And the thumb said, I am the most important finger. I'm the opposable thumb, which allows you to hold things. And I'm the strongest. And when you say okay, I'm the one you pick up, put up. I am the okay finger. I am the best, the okay finger. And this one said, absolutely rubbish. I am the most important finger because I am the finger of wisdom. I point out things to people. I'm the index finger. And wisdom is valued above all other things. And also, when you say number one, which one do you put up? Me. I am the number one finger. And the middle finger said, you're all wrong. I am the best. Not only I am the tallest, can see furthest, I am the middle finger, and the middle way is the most important thing in Buddhism, the middle way. And if you don't believe me, just put me up the other way, you see how powerful I am. I'm sure your kids know what I mean. Don't think, Ajahn Brahm, you're just corrupting our children. They know the one finger sign. This one said, no, I am the most important finger of all. Why? Because I am the finger of love. When you get engaged, you put the ring on me. When you get married, I also receive the wedding ring. And without love, wisdom is okay, and strength is okay, but what's life without love? So I am the most important finger because I am the finger of love. And that left this fellow, this small little fellow here, and he said, actually guys, you're all wrong. I am the most important finger. And I'll explain why. Even though you use me to do dirty things, even though I do dirty things, when you pray to the Buddha, I am the finger always closest to the Buddha. So the person who does the dirty housework in the house is the one who is closest to the Buddha. So you should be fighting over the housework. So all of you people who come to this temple, who are going to leave this evening, the ones who are closest to the Buddha are the ones who help clean up after my talk. Very good. Okay, next question. Maybe just go for another 5 minutes and then 9:30 finish off. Because you people have got to go to work tomorrow. I can't ruin the English economy by making you tired when you go to work. Yeah. At the back, yes. Very good. Okay, is the digital revolution making a similar effect to the industrial revolution, separating people from humanity? Because I am sort of know what goes on in Silicon Valley. Last June there was a big conference and all the major IT companies attended, and the theme of the conference was this: disconnect to connect. And that was a theme, and that all the big shots there from Apple, from PayPal, from Google, Microsoft, Twitter, all the big shots were there, and they realized the problem of kids sitting next to each other, not talking, but tweeting to each other, and never being off their smartphones. So they realized there's a problem, and so their theme of the conference was disconnect your devices so you can connect with your friends, with your parents, and also so you can connect with yourself. The problem is realized. And those guys up in Silicon Valley, they just know the problem, they're trying to solve it. So, if you want to connect with people, disconnect your devices. Disconnect it. And then you can not only connect with others, you can connect with yourself. So yeah, it is a problem, recognized, and solutions are being found. Disconnect to connect. Okay, one last question from the back, and then we finish off. Yeah. Over here. You have to stand up and you have to shout. Okay, I'll do that question. If you want to become a stream winner in this life, what sort of practice should you do? And very clear from the Buddha, Eightfold Path. That's a practice of a Buddhist, to become enlightened, to become a stream winner, Eightfold Path. So, right view, right intention. Right intention means thoughts, actions of letting go, kindness, and gentleness. So if you want to become a stream winner, before you go, there's the donation box over there. Let go. Be kind to the monks. And nuns, yeah. So we don't have donation boxes in my temple in Perth. We only have letting go boxes. And then keep your precepts, right speech, right action, right livelihood. You've got to put a lot of energy in your practice. Don't be lazy. The right effort, mindfulness, and stillness. The eightfold path. And if you miss any one of those out, you know, you're hindering any opportunity to become a stream winner. The teaching of the Buddha is so clear. Eightfold path, eightfold path, eightfold path. People always want to take shortcuts. Well, meditation's too difficult. You know, generosity, I'm poor. Precepts, well, you've got to live in the real world, you know, so you've got to have a beer with your friends. This is the land. You're always whining. So just do it. If you want to be a stream winner, eightfold path. That's the only way. And do it as much as you can, while you can. Okay, thank you for listening today. Thank you.
So I want to give a big thank to Ajahn. So we have been given a talk more than nearly
2.5 hours.
2.5 hours.
Actually more than that, because I was talking to the kids
We all enjoyed your talk every single minute. Actually, it is like Buddhism with smiling.
Yeah.
So we are very happy being able to provide an opportunity to many people today to listen to our speaker, very remarkable person. And it is a memorable day for all of us, being able to listen to such a wonderful, world-renowned teacher. Also, he's actually not only a spiritual teacher, also a popular speaker. So therefore, little bit worried, because I had a telephone conversation in the evening. Friend of mine, I told him that Ajahn Brahm come in the evening. Oh, you may have a trouble. I asked, why? Oh, you can't provide enough space to people. Exactly thing happened. We are worried because we haven't enough space to everybody to sit in comfortably. But very happy evening. Is a memorable and it's a remarkable teacher. So both children and adults, we enjoyed and benefited. Thank you very much. On behalf of all the congregation, I would like to convey our sincere gratitude and our appreciation. And rather than clapping hands, I ask you to say, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Thank you. It's custom for us to offer an atapirikar bhanti. Say sadhu, 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 sadhu.
And Venerable, yes. It is a custom in London. Please put up your hand to do. By the way. Very good. So East meets West. Very good. Thank you so much. So good night, everybody. Please drive carefully. If you get in a traffic jam, great opportunity to become enlightened.